Welcome to International Edition. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Ahead, an expert speaks about the conflict in Iraq as violence flares in that nation. We take a look at the military tug of war in Yemen. Our cyber guru tells us about something old that is new again.
Steganography is the art of hiding something within something else.
And we talk to a priest about the Pope's upcoming visit to the U.S. It's here on the Voice of America. A massive truck bombing Thursday in Baghdad's Shia Sadr city area killed at least 62 people at a crowded market. The Islamic State claimed responsibility. International Edition's Jeffrey Young, who very closely follows Middle East and terrorist developments, went to the analysts to get more on what is behind this attack and the Islamic State's campaign to conquer Iraq. And Jeffrey joins me here in the studio right now. And Jeffrey, what did you find out?
Hi, Susan. I discussed this Baghdad bombing, its significance for the government of Prime Minister Haider al-Hadi, and beyond that, the need for a coordinated regional strategy against the Islamic State with Royal United Services Institute analyst Afzal Ashraf.
Almost certainly that's part of the message that is being sent out. It's not entirely clear everything that has been behind this bombing. For example, we know that there are claims that the Iraqi Air Force bombed Fallujah, and some of those bombs allegedly landed on a maternity hospital. And of course, Fallujah is very largely dominated by the IS, the Islamic State or Daesh forces. So it may be partly a revenge attack for that. It could also send out a message to the Iraqi government, as you suggest, that it may well also targeting the Shia militia. The Sadr militia may well be an attempt to divide the primary militia groups, the Sadr and the Badr Corps militias, against each other.
The outgoing U.S. Army Chief of Staff, General Ray Ordinaro, said on Wednesday that Washington should consider embedding American troops with Iraqi forces. When you're fighting an asymmetrical war, especially against something such as the Islamic State, I would imagine that the most important factor, or one of the most important factors, would be a coordinated strategy between American and Iraqi forces. Please speak to that.
Well, that is something that I've been writing and speaking about for over a year, and that to me is an amazing situation, that generals who know strategy more than anybody else don't mention strategy, and every time we have a setback, they said, well, let's do a bit more of this, let's send more troops out, let's do this, let's do that, do more training. But what is missing is a coordinated strategy in all of this. What we don't have is an international strategy. So how the U.S., the coalition, the Iraqi forces, the Iranian support is being coordinated. What we don't have is a coordination between air and land strategy. We have an air campaign that is being led by the U.S. with the coalition forces, but there appears to be very little, if any, coordination between that air campaign and the land campaign that is being led by the Iraqis. So what we have is a huge gap in success, and that is the absence of a single coordinated strategy that brings together the efforts and the actions of all the many players involved.
That was Royal United Services Institute consulting fellow Afzal Ashraf.
You know, Jeff, at this point, it just seems like Iraq and Syria have become just one big conflict. Is that correct?
Regarding the Islamic State, yes, Susan, that's true. That's why Mr. Ashraf stressed the need for a coordinated regional strategy against these terrorists.
Well, thanks for bringing us that report, Jeffrey.
As always, Susan.
International Edition's Michael Lippin has been looking at some disturbing images on Twitter of the aftermath of this attack, and he's here in the studio with me. Michael, what have you seen?
Hi, Susan. Well, you know, some of the photos that appear to be from the targeted market in Baghdad show the bodies of people and animals strewn among the debris of fruits and vegetables. One photo even showed a horse that survived the attack standing bloodied on the street. If you want to see what the destruction looked like without those graphic images, you can go to the YouTube channel of the Associated Press and look for the video titled "Raw: Baghdad Truck Bomb Kills Dozens." The AP's Baghdad bureau chief Vivian Salama also tweeted about today's attack. Her handle is @VMSalama, and she described it this way: "Rough morning in Baghdad. An Islamic State truck bomb tore through a popular market in the Sadr City district, at least 62 people dead. The damage is extensive." Another social media reaction to the truck bombing comes from the United Nations Assistance Mission for Iraq, or UNAMI, which is on Twitter @UNIraq. It tweeted an image of a press release from acting UN envoy to Iraq, Georgi Bustin, who condemned the attack. He also called it an indiscriminate act of terrorism aimed at weakening the resolve of the Iraqi people, and he said, "I have no doubt in my mind that the terrorists will fail." Susan?
Well, thank you, Michael, for that report. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
Russian microbiologists have found that a new strain of yeast was quite effective in treating wastewater that contains certain toxic chemical compounds. Conducting their research at peat bogs in western Siberia, the scientists from Kazan Federal University found that this new yeast strain was effective in eliminated nitro compounds. These organic compounds are commonly used in such products as explosives, insecticides, polymers, dyes, and some medications. The scientists focused on a waste product called trinitrotoluene, which is known to be a serious health threat. High numbers of this nitro compound waste are produced by industries such as oil refineries and military equipment manufacturers. I am VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
The announcement by the Yemeni government about liberating the entire city of Aden signaled key shifts on the military scene in Yemen as Houthis and militias loyal to former President Ali Abdullah Saleh retreat. International Edition's Mohammed El-Shenawi spoke with Stephen Sesh, former U.S. ambassador to Yemen, about the reasons behind that shift and its implications. And he joins me here in the studio. Welcome, Mohammed.
Thank you.
Well, Mohammed, what happened?
We all know. So the Houthis, backed by forces loyal to former president in Yemen, Ali Abdullah Saleh, used force to impose their will on the rest of the population. So it was force from the Saudi-led alliance that rolled them back, as Ambassador Sesh explains.
The tipping point was the very extraordinary support given by the United Arab Emirates and, of course, the Saudis, too, both of which now have introduced ground forces. The Emiratis have brought a armored brigade of some 3,000 men in through Aden, and the Saudis have sent an armored column down from Saudi Arabia from the north, moving towards Marib and towards the east of the capital, Sana'a. So I think that introduction of ground forces in a very robust way, including some of the training that they've done, the Saudis and the Emiratis have done with Yemeni forces, pro-Hadi forces, has also been a big factor in taking the momentum away from the Houthis and those forces allied with former President Saleh.
Oman is reportedly trying to offer an initiative to end the conflict through a negotiated settlement, but Yemeni President Hadi insisted that he will not accept anything short of full adherence to the UN Security Council Resolution 2216. What would that mean?
Well, so according to Ambassador Sesh, usually negotiations starts with each side taking a maximal position. But the situation in Yemen would not allow an application of winner-takes-it-all approach.
That the desperation, the urgency, is a result of the enormous humanitarian cost this conflict has placed on Yemen, the number of people who are suffering from near starvation, the internally displaced population, the disease that's spreading. All of this argues very persuasively to me that all the parties now need to begin to talk with each other to see what they can each receive.
This scenario takes into consideration that the high cost of the conflict and the involvement of many parties on several fronts makes it better to reach a political settlement as quickly as possible. But Ambassador Sesh hopes that the pro-legitimacy coalition would realize that Houthis and Saleh loyalists cannot be entirely excluded or defeated, but rather contained and forced to accept a settlement.
This can't be resolved unless everyone is prepared to give a little bit more than perhaps they would like to going into the negotiation, and that includes Awad Ali Abdullah Saleh. And I do hope that when we get to the into the negotiation stage, the Houthis will see that what they should be doing is heading back up towards Saada, to those areas in the north that are historically theirs, and concessions can be made too in terms of geographical areas that they can have and control.
The military defeat in Aden may force Houthis to become more pragmatic and accept a political settlement to avoid further losses and to boost their position in the political process in the phase following the end of military operations.
Thank you, Mohammed, for your insight.
Thank you, Sue.
Coming up on International Edition, the meaning of steganography to a cyber warrior, and a sneak peek at the Pope's U.S. visit. From time to time, International Edition cyber correspondent Doug Bernard joins us to share stories of some new tool to help guard your privacy online or a new computer virus that's spreading around the Internet. But today, he's bringing us the story of a very old technique that was once the favorite of spies and that's now finding new life in the digital world. And Doug, what do you got for us? Are you going to scare us again and make us change our passwords and all this again? What's going on?
So what we have today is something called steganography. Now, as you say, steganography is a very old technique. It's been employed for well over 1,000 years, but it's finding new applications in the digital world. And in fact, one recently announced bit of malware, a very sophisticated, perhaps one of the most sophisticated digital attack vectors that I've come across professionally.
What's the difference between that and just encrypting a message?
Well, so basically, steganography is the art of hiding something within something else. So think about invisible ink, right? You could have something as ordinary as an old grocery list, but a spy with the right chemicals can encode secret messages on that very ordinary-looking thing and communicate all kinds of secrets that can be decoded later. Steganography in the digital world is very much the same thing. So it's hiding perhaps a bit of code or an image or some text within something else, like a picture of a dog or a text file or Beyonce MP3. So the difference, however, between encryption and steganography is encryption is a cloaked message, right? When you see it, you know there's a secret there. You just can't get at it, because if you see an encrypted message, it's just garbled text, and you can get to work saying, well, aha, I know that this is a bit of coded message, and I can try and start breaking the code. What makes steganography so dangerous, I guess, is that it's, as they say, hiding out in the open. So think about the thousands and thousands of plain old text documents that we see every day, a Word document, an image, a picture, that kind of thing. You know, it's within those things that are innocuous that increasingly are being used as vectors to transmit some very serious malware.
You keep talking about steganography. Now, I can barely say that word. So what is it anyway?
So it's a technique. The word comes from a Latin scholar working, I think, about 1,200 years ago, who wrote sort of the first codex. And so it's, as I say, a technique of hiding one thing within the other. So imagine, for example, that you have a picture of your dog, right? Now, that's a digital picture online. There's all kinds of code in there. But there's also all kinds of space in there as well, digital space. And what, again, it's a sophisticated technique. Not everybody can do this. But what the bad guys increasingly are doing is taking bits of bad code or command code that will take control of your computer, that kind of thing, and hiding it in the empty spaces of a picture of a dog so cleverly that there's no way to really detect that it's in there.
Well, can we detect it?
Only with some very sophisticated techniques.
Not changing your password this time. No, because usually you say that every time
right.
I see you.
And it's still good advice, but that's not going to help you in this case. There was an example recently of a bit of malware called HammerToss. And HammerToss, it's very complex. It uses several layers. But in effect, what it does, it's a bit of a malware that sits on your computer and once a day quietly goes out to Twitter. It looks for a couple pre-programmed Twitter accounts. This is something that no computer network person would ever think twice about because Twitter is a very safe, accepted service. But occasionally the bad guys, when they want to activate HammerToss, they'll put a picture on their Twitter account with a hashtag. And basically in that picture, once your computer looks at it, it stores the image in its cache, and the hashtag is basically a map for the malware to find the command and control code. All of this is happening completely under the radar of you, of your computer, even the network administrators.
I lied. You were here to scare me again. Okay, thanks for coming, Doug.
You bet.
This is VOA.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
Hashtag VOA. It's a weekly show, Tuesdays at 1730 UTC, where we bring you the top topics of the week. But the show lives on social media every day with your daily video shorts, What's Trending Wednesday, and the Friday Fast Five. Subscribe to the show at YouTube. You can find us at hashtag VOA. You can reach me at Twitter, at Perry Cal, or talk to the show anytime. Please don't forget to like us on Facebook. We like to be liked. We love to be seen. And you can reach us anytime.
Pope Francis is visiting the United States next month, and there is a lot of excitement about the event. My colleague Alexis Christophorus got a preview from Reverend Michael Russo, a communications professor at St. Mary's College.
Well, we're seeing a man with amazing simplicity and just an amazing way to reach out to people. Mm-hmm. His messages to the U.S. Congress or to the United Nations, his major addresses, I think will be pretty predictable in the sense that his agenda has already been set. He speaks about issues of climate warming with his new encyclical. He speaks about immigration, issues such as human trafficking and modern slavery. And of course, he is very interested in the whole issue of immigration. He sees them all quite connected. That's why in his encyclical, he talks about kind of an integral ecology that we as people of the world, as a global pope, mm-hmm. have to see the interconnections of the economy, issues of food, issues of health, being integrally connected mm-hmm. to the people of the world.
And he has voiced his feelings about the economy, the disparity that exists between the low class, the wealthy, and how we sort of need to close that gap and that divide, especially in places like the emerging countries like in Africa. Mm-hmm. But tell us a little bit more about his thinking there.
Well, of course, he comes from the global south, right? He comes from South America. Interestingly, with the development of this encyclical, Cardinal Turkson, who's from Africa, helped him write the encyclical. He was one of the editors. Mm-hmm. So it's, you know, these are the deep concerns of people who are on the outside. You know, they look at the capitalistic world, the world of consumerism, and kind of wonder what are the people, those people who are left out, how are they going to fare in this global economy.
Mm-hmm. He was recently in Latin America, where he gave a very sort of rousing speech mm-hmm. about a number of things, and he did talk about the economy, and he apologized on behalf of the Roman Catholic Church for Spanish colonialism. But then he also talked about the new colonialism. Mm-hmm. What did he mean by this?
Well, by the new colonialism, he's referring, of course, to the way in which corporations, you know, move their work from one place to another, mm-hmm. and somehow through technology, people are on the outs. Interestingly enough, 20 years ago, when I was here at NYU, I had a wonderful professor by the name of Neil Postman, mm-hmm. who wrote a book which was controversial at the time, called Technopoly, and how we so rely upon technology, what mm-hmm. the Pope is saying, we have to rely on one another, and that the moral crises of the world are not going to be resolved by market capitalism, mm-hmm. but by a convergence of good people attempting to address the needs and hurts of the larger number of people around the world, particularly those who are poor in undeveloped countries.
And this probably speaks to this quote. He recently was quoted as saying, we need to put the economy at the service of peoples. Mm-hmm. Expound upon that a little bit.
Well, here we are. We're steps away from Wall Street. I've always interested in things like impact investing, mm-hmm. which is a specific way in which corporations with a conscience
right.
could put the money to work that are going to have specific effects in health, in education. I'm thinking of the Gates Foundation and in ways in which they've been able to address particularly places in Africa
right.
where there needs to be easier, more clear methods of addressing such simple things, and from our terms, as TB.
Mm-hmm.
And that is an important way in which impact investing could really change the face of the earth.
And they made big sweeping changes when it comes to malaria as well.
Exactly.
During your tenure as a priest, you have seen many popes, and you've actually covered Pope John Paul II, Pope Benedict, and now Pope Francis. I'm sure you're asked this often, but similarities between the three, mm-hmm. or maybe perhaps the largest differences?
I'll be even bolder. He's the best pope in my lifetime as a priest.
That's my colleague Alexis Christophorus speaking with Reverend Michael Russo about the Pope's visit to the United States, which we're all excited about.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In China's Zhejiang province, authorities are carrying out a campaign to remove crosses from thousands of church roofs, spires, and archways. Under the purported justification of building code violations, more than 1,000 crosses have reportedly been toppled or stripped away over the past year and a half. In addition, since 2014, more than 400 churches have reportedly faced partial or total demolition by the government, claiming the buildings were illegal structures. The U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom, an independent bipartisan federal commission, noted that many Christian believers in Zhejiang regard the campaign to remove the crosses and raise churches as directly targeting their religion. And they have not been silent about it. In July, Chinese Catholic officials described the dismantling of crosses on churches as an evil act. Christians took to the streets in protest in the southeastern city of Guangzhou. The Associated Press reported that in a rare move, China's semi-official Christian associations, which are supposed to ensure the ruling Communist Party's control over Protestant and Catholic groups, denounced the campaign against the crosses, claiming it risks alienating Christians from the government. Christians are not the only religious group targeted by officials in China. In its report, the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom noted that in the past year, there have been unprecedented violations against Uyghur Muslims, Tibetan Buddhists, and Falun Gong practitioners, in addition to Christians. Since 1999, the U.S. Secretary of State has designated China as a country of particular concern for severe violations of religious freedom. In its most recently published report, the State Department said that despite a constitutional guarantee that Chinese citizens enjoy freedom of religious belief, the government harassed, assaulted, detained, arrested, or sentenced to prison a number of religious adherents for activities reported to be related to their religious beliefs and practices. Secretary of State John Kerry has called freedom of religion a universal value ingrained in every human heart. He also pointed out that when countries undermine or attack religious freedom, they not only unjustly threaten those whom they target, they also threaten their country's own stability. The United States continues to call on all countries, including China, to live up to their international human rights commitments regarding religious freedom and allow their citizens the full exercise of this fundamental right and moral imperative.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.